There have been some really good books coming out in South Africa recently, which is something of a difference. I've been quite scathing in a number of the books that I've read here. Some of them should never have been written. One that just had to be written, and it's excellent. It's a must read, and I hope they turn it into a movie, is Malema, Money, Power, Patronage by Micah Reddy and Polly van Wyk. Micah's with us. And we'll get some insights on what went into this, and indeed some of the issues, some of the big questions that are raised when you read through this book in detail. Micah, it's only officially launched next week. You were telling me off air, but already you're into your second print run, man. It deserves it. It's unusual to have a second print run before you've even officially launched. But I suppose we have to start at the beginning. And what got you and Polly to decide to write this book, given the high profile of the guy that you are exposing here and all of those miscreants around him and his penchant for going after anybody who criticizes him?
Well, there's a long backstory to the book. Polly and I arrived at the story from very different angles. Her route was very much through VBS. She was, sort of stuck in the VBS scandal and of course Malema and Floyd Chivambu's fingerprints were all over that. So that's really what got her, focused on the EFF. I started developing a particular interest in the EFF somewhat by accident. I was looking, I'd actually just started out in investigative journalism. So we're going back quite a few years now. And I was looking at malfeasance in the metros. This was after the 2016 local government elections, and the metros were now dominated by coalitions. There was a sea change. And I wasn't specifically looking for EFF interference, but whenever I looked into a series of very questionable tenders, and the EFF kept coming up. And whenever I spoke to city officials, this was particularly in the city of Johannesburg, I kept hearing about how the EFF were wielding sort of outsized clout in the metros and were calling the shots and influencing appointments and meddling in tenders, even though they weren't formally in Mashaba's coalition. And then also there were other colleagues. I was at Amabungane at the time. Other colleagues were receiving information about the EFF. And the picture that started to emerge was that they had become key power brokers in the metros. And this was sort of a kind of very important political focal point for them. But this is how Malema and Chivambu and their party were all amassing wealth, and how they were sort of consolidating a patronage network. And so I wrote a series of stories on the metros while Polly was writing about their involvement in VBS and tracking their various slush funds, these sort of front companies linked to relatives and close associates of Malema and Floyd in particular. And we both started to build up this quite complex picture of their respective networks, which were very much overlapping in the case of Chivambu and Malema in particular. And at some point after we'd written a whole lot, we were approached about a book deal. Polly at the time was very busy. She couldn't really take it on. I started chipping away at it. It didn't really go anywhere for a while until we realized at some stage, I can't remember exactly what the turning point was, but we thought, we've amassed a lot here. And in the course of their being Floyd and Julius's relatively short but illustrious careers, they had amassed a lot of scandals. And we had just so much information on them that we were sitting on. And of course, Malema is just a very compelling political figure. He's very influential. He's very colorful. He's interesting to write about. He's brilliant in many ways. There were so many reasons we wanted to tell this story and to put all the information that we had in one place, but also to bring in a whole lot more that we hadn't yet written about. And so over the course of a few years we've been doing this, it's really been a long time coming. Part of the reason is there's just been so much to write about. We had to do a lot more digging, but also because of the nature of the content we're writing about, it's of course very legally sensitive. So the book has been very thoroughly legal. It's been edited. The editing process was quite onerous. But now it is finally out. And that's the story of how it all happened.
Well, it's quite extraordinary. It's I suppose there are many big questions, and let's start with the obvious one. You have compiled the evidence in a way that any prosecuting attorney would be terribly proud. You've joined the dots. The late Pravin Gordhan would be very happy to endorse the work you've done there as well. It's difficult to understand why those that we charge with enforcing law in South Africa have not enforced law and put these Malema and Shivambu and their cronies behind bars years and years ago. We'll get on to the other issues, but that one has got to be, anybody reading this book is with even a smidgen of attention has got to come to that conclusion. Why?
Well, this is the question that was in the back of our heads throughout the book writing process, and something that we've tried to explain in the book. Why has he not been held to account? It is a big question. It's tricky to answer. Part of it has to do, surely, with political will. The fact that Malema is so influential and to many in the criminal justice system, he probably seems untouchable. A lot of it has to do with the lack of capacity, of course. And state capture, as much as Julius Malema was one of Zuma's fiercest critics during Zuma's time in power at the height of state capture, and as much as he called out state capture time and time again in parliament and elsewhere, he was in many ways a beneficiary of it. He was involved in his own form of state capture. He was embedded in these networks of what we might call state capture. But the biggest way in which he has benefited, arguably, is in what state capture did to law enforcement, the criminal justice system, and to institutions like SARS. You know, the SARS was a sort of world-leading, a shining example of an accountable, effective revenue authority. Was gutted under Zuma and is probably still recovering from the years of state capture. Now, SARS was very hot on Malema's trail. You know, he was tangled up in litigation with SARS for a very long time. Poli covered this very extensively. He had assets attached. SARS had uncovered many, many millions of Malema's money that he tried to keep hidden. And yet he has not been held to account because the criminal justice system is broken. It is, as I said, still recovering from state capture. There is clearly a lack of political will. There is an inability to properly investigate, let alone prosecute complex financial crime. And over the years, although he has been incredibly brazen in many of his dubious schemes, he has gotten somewhat more sophisticated over the years at concealing his money. But at the same time, the criminal justice system has sort of fallen behind and is showing increasing signs of weakness and is in some cases falling apart at the seams. We know that the Hawks, for instance, are completely incapable of taking on complicated, politically sensitive cases. And also these authorities are all overwhelmed, right? I mean, we chose Malema as a case study because he so sort of exemplified a type of, or his case rather exemplified a type of patronage. And because we had so much information on him. But this is, you know, the rot is absolutely systemic. It wasn't just state capture under Zuma. It is everywhere, as the Madlanga Commission has shown. You know, these networks, a lot of that is unproven, but I think it points to a pattern of just systemic state capture of sprawling criminal networks intersecting with politicians at a low level and at the highest level of government.
Well, your co-author, Paulie van Wyk, has preferred not to go on camera. But Paulie, lovely to be chatting with you about this this brilliant book that the two of you put together. I guess I don't want to get into too much detail on what's in the book because it is a must read. Okay, that's if you're in business, if you care about South Africa, that's what you need to do. And I've read it and it's superb. But right of the moment, and you kind of opened the door there, little Micah, and I'd love to hear Paulie's view and then yours. Who is right in this whole Mkhwanazi affair? Is he ripping the Band-Aid off? Is he finally going to give us a route into seeing people like Malema prosecuted, or is this just further subterfuge and something more that we're going to have to deal with as a nation? I guess the real to encapsulate that, Paulie, is the Mkhwanazi disclosure good for the country, or is it going to take us up another poor path?
Thanks for having me. Sorry, I have a bit of a wonky Wi-Fi, so I'm just keeping to audio. When we talk about the Mkhwanazi revelations, I am a firm believer in the sun being a really good disinfectant, and that the sun should shine on the facts. And Mkhwanazi definitely has a story to tell. There's, of course, a need for him to prove and back up what he say. But for now, and I've listened to parts of his testimony, it definitely seems as if there's massive problems with Ngunu and the allegations Mkhwanazi made, purely through the sequence of events and how the investigative teams came upon the phone of one of the crooks by accident and then realized that there was a weird triage between one of the crooks and the minister and an advisor. So it's a and. I think Micah speaks of Malema's case as an exemplified story of broader corruption. And I think this is another example of just how much the hawks are falling apart at the seams. And the big trouble we are in, you know, how networks, criminal networks have gained traction inside our justice system.
I was a guest yesterday in an editor's round table with business leadership, and it was they have one of their four focus areas is crime and the criminal justice system. And Neil Froneman was telling us all about he leads that part. He's the CEO of Sibanye-Stillwater. He leads that stream. He was telling us how much progress there had been done. But even he had to admit that, in his terms, it was very disappointing what's come out with Mkhwanazi, but he said that maybe there's another side to the story. If you guys, the two of you, given the evidence, and I mentioned this earlier, Paulie, to Micah, that you've put the case together for any state prosecutor who wants to take on a whole list of miscreants, that they should be put behind bars. If you guys were talking to business leadership who are spending a lot of time doing things to help the country, what would you advise them to do to get the criminal justice system back in order? Micah, you want to kick off with that?
That's a tricky one and maybe a little above my pay grade as a humble journalist. But I think you know, business has real clout in governance. Business has a seat at the table. As much as, you know, the ANC in government is criticized routinely for not listening, business does have the ear of the ANC in a way that other sectors don't. I think procurement is absolutely key here, right? And procurement is not just, it's not, or procurement corruption is not only the fault of government and politicians. In every case, jobs and services are being outsourced to private actors. So I think there needs to be a massive push for procurement reform, especially, you know, considering this, the type of corruption we're talking about that the book focuses very heavily on, namely procurement corruption. Strengthening the criminal justice system, strengthening law enforcement is also critical. I don't, you know, I can't really prescribe. I'm not a governance expert. I don't know what exactly the private sector should be doing. I know there have been initiatives to channel some private money into bolstering law enforcement and the hawks and so on. But we need strong, independent crime-fighting institutions. That is critical. And then, I mean, so much of the problem is kind of self-perpetuating, the problem of corruption, right? We tend to focus on these sort of headline stories, the big corruption. But there's so much at a lower level, at a municipal level, at a provincial level. A lot of it we try and bring into the book as well, where the rot is deep, and you know, corruption erodes the state and the state's ability to provide services and jobs, which only perpetuates corruption as people sort of scramble by any means necessary to accumulate resources to earn to make a living, and that, you know, further undermines the criminal justice system. So it's a very hard thing to understand how to disentangle. One can see how corruption is so sort of deeply embedded in South Africa and how it's causing such enormous harm. How to begin to try and undo that is very difficult. But there's, I think, whereas my answer would be that, like, if you want to look at practical areas, procurement corruption is a big thing, and somehow strengthening the criminal justice system, I think there probably is a greater role for the private sector.
My suggestion would be, first of all, just read this book, and then your eyes will be opened, and you'll know there'll be a hit list of people that you don't do business with. But Polly, your thoughts?
I do think it is a tricky question, because I do not believe that business necessarily must fund the justice cluster. It's not the business of big business in South Africa to do that. And you create a partisan alleyway for just more corruption, perpetuating an already existing problem. My personal opinion here would be that business must also get their house in order. Corruption cannot exist in a vacuum, in a state or a governance vacuum. You need big business and small business, as Micah just mentioned, to cooperate and to be the corruptor. So in the Malema story, we can see that often, and there are so many stories that we didn't add, that didn't make it to the book, where people would say, business people, and I'm talking about all races and all classes here. It's not Malema's the nicest person that you'll ever meet, and we protect him because we can phone him and he'll sort us out when we have a problem. So what's happening there is a symbiotic relationship between business people, often farmers in Limpopo and so on, between Malema and trouble, where the entire state system, the entire governance system is falling apart, where there's protests, or there's water that's not working, or there's unrest. And then Malema is called upon to either quash it or to help, lend a helping hand. So it's not, we need to understand the ecosystem that this is living and procreating in as well. So it's an ecosystem that I think the ANC for the past, 25 years have just allowed to be perpetuated into oblivion and to really become a massive problem. But then also business that cannot be corrupted or corrupt because they are a part of the bigger story. And I do think then that we need to pressurize the ANC to to self-correct. But I'm skeptical about that as I'm saying it, because I don't think that the ANC is at the point where they can self-correct. So people in the country must vote. And if we vote for the ANC, then we're happy with a very corrupt government that allows a justice cluster to have been imploded and to perpetuate those problems. I can't see it correcting very soon under the current management.
But when you talk about people voting, if you consider, Paulie, the fact that about 10% of South Africans who do vote voted for Julius Malema, and the work you guys have done it really documents it very well. How does that hypocrisy, and it's profound hypocrisy, really, because here you've got a political party that says we're socialists, we're here for the poor, but actually it's exactly the opposite side, where they are harming the poor. And you articulated that so well in your coverage of VBS, both in the book and the articles there. So how does he get it right?
Well, I think my understanding of Julius Malema is that it's Julius first, always, and the EFF and other people second, and South Africa maybe third or fourth down the line. So Malema, I think the book shows that he uses his power to gain more money, and that money he uses to gain more power. So, and Floyd is much the same. There are examples in the book where charity has been spent on people in need. And of course, that relates to a number of vote buying as well. But then often the people who receive the charity do not realize that they were the ones being robbed, and in the first instance, to have been given the charity in the end. There's a story where Floyd bought wheelchairs with VBS money from the people that he gave them. The VBS money was stolen from the people he gave the wheelchairs to. So that already should tell us that there's a big problem in the system.
If I can add something to that, I think
sure,
it's an important point that you raise. You know, for all the glaring hypocrisy and the hypocrisy when it comes to Malema and Shivambu and other EFF leaders is absolutely glaring. He is still channeling very legitimate grievances, right? And he does so very effectively. He's a very compelling, very, you know, thunderous political frontman, and he is a voice for the marginalized. Even if he is a hypocrite and he is opportunistic and corrupt and whatever else anyone, whatever other labels one may choose to use. And this goes back to a previous point of yours, which is, well, what can business do? I think the realization has to arrive at some point that serious reform is needed in this country, not just in terms of governance, but, you know, there has to be some level of redistribution here. There has to be some level of, we need job creation. We need a better sort of welfare net for the most marginalized, because otherwise these grievances are going to fester, and people like Malema are very, you know, these sort of populist radicals who don't have a sort of, I would say that Malema's radicalism is often very dangerous because it is so populist and so anti-constitutional. And it is so kind of governed by his own ego, by, you know, himself. It's so sort of centered around the commander in chief. But he and political forces like MK are always going to have a kind of base of support if we cannot address the sort of fundamental structural problems in South African society. You know, how we go about doing that is a whole lot of debate. But I think that is somewhere where business certainly can step in. And business must, and we talk about business as if it's one monolithic thing. Business is hugely varied. But, you know, we know from, for instance, state capture really underscored, big sort of blue chip companies, supposedly squeaky clean, high end companies, were deeply embedded in networks of corruption and enabled high-level state capture and benefited from it. So there has to be a reckoning with that as well. And we've gone some way towards it, but, you know, with these endless commissions, but we're still a way off real kind of really addressing the sort of nuts and bolts of the problem.
Yeah, yeah. Well, good point. And if you were to rewind the clock to 1994, you would have said to big business, don't make these people rich just because you can get them to say what you want them to say. Put the empowerment into the hands of the many. Otherwise, you are going to create people like Malema. So very, very good point. Before we go, though, there are some heroes in your book. And two people that were interesting, Honeycomb and Ravat. Now, I take it that, well, obviously these are not their real names, but these whistleblowers risked so much. And I know that two of you are in a world where you're risking so much as well. What is it? What is it, Poli, about you? And I'm sure you're thousands of fans would love to know the answer to this question that makes you do what you do despite the very obvious risks that you're running on a personal basis.
Well, it's an interesting question to ask because when you're in the midst and the thick of things, you don't necessarily think about it in these rational lines. Looking back, I can say that I was never scared of doing it. I think there's a personal way of working where I just love to ferret out a secret, you know. And if I realize that there's a puzzle to be built and clues lead me to one little puzzle block to the next, I just want to sort of find out what's happening and what's hidden behind the wall. So that would be it's a personal view on our journalism work. But then the second is I realized later after the attacks came, after people you know, said the most horrible things, and we, some people were, I think, a little afraid for our lives. I just realized if we're not doing it, no one will. If Micah and I are not brave and if we don't go on and just shine a light on the truth, it's not going to be done. There's so much, and every journalist around us tend to focus on their specific sector or their niche of what they can, you know, what they can do or what they can shine a light on. And this, completely by accident, Malema became ours, and we just try to do the best we can there.
But he's a hectic guy to go after, Micah. He certainly does not hold back in his criticism of those who criticize him. So from your perspective, I get what Poli says there. There's a puzzle. You want to find the answer to it. But at some point in time, you have to think about your family, yourself, and this crazy guy who, well, could stir up even more crazy people who believe him to harm those who are criticizing him. How do you deal with that in your own mind?
So yeah, we're very used to being labeled agents of Stratcom and being defamed in ways like that. So far, and we sort of saw this coming, so far Malema has been very quiet about this book. In fact, I don't think he said anything about it, really, not publicly. He's quite media savvy. He plays to the chorus very well. He plays the media very well. But with Poli and I, he's sort of disengaged. I think because he really doesn't have an answer to the evidence we've put before him. And so the EFF sort of just refused to engage with us. And I don't, you know, as much as there are kind of thuggish elements within the party, I didn't think he was going to come after us sort of physically. I thought the big risk was legal. And we protected ourselves very carefully. We had, you know, an excellent team of lawyers. The other people we write about in this book and that we've written about elsewhere, that's often a different story. So, you know, sometimes I think the most dangerous players are sort of relatively obscure mid-level actors who are, I think, often sort of, you know, they have a lot more to lose. They may be sort of violent criminals or associated with kind of criminal networks, and may have a very different way of doing business. And I think that's where, and I'm speaking beyond the book here, just sort of generally as investigative journalists, that's where we need to be concerned. If you look at like the stuff that Jeff Wicks has been writing, these sort of criminal networks around Tembisa Hospital, and he's writing about a whistleblower who was assassinated. You know, those are very, very dangerous actors, which is not to say we don't get flack from, and Bodhi's had horrific abuse online for years and years and keeps pegging away at it. And I think the reason is, I mean, the journalists, investigative journalists are motivated by different things. Some of us are very nerdy and academic and we get sort of fixated on a topic and want to figure it out. Some of us, I suppose, are adrenaline junkies, but there's a lot to keep us going. And I think we, you know, the reward is when you produce, you know, a hard-hitting story or a book like this. And we also have to acknowledge that we have a pretty good support network. So like I mentioned, we were very, very well lawyered up and had good, careful editors.
My former colleague and probably the earliest of the investigators, well, one of, not the earliest, but one of the earliest, Barry Sargent, who used to play in this field, always said that the most dangerous time was before you publish, because that was when people like Brett Kebble, et cetera, wanted to prevent you from doing it. And I mean, we know that that he shot Stephen Mildenhall or had him shot and all kinds of other things that go through there. But final question, guys. Poli, starting with you, what are you hoping to achieve with this book?
For the first time, the story of Malema and his modus operandi has been told for in themes as we can go back until about a decade or almost two, from around 2005. We tracked his ways, the way that he works, and we realize that he's getting smarter at it. And I want people to know, after this, no one should be able to say, but we didn't know. We were uninformed. You know what you're voting for.
Marco?
That too, but I think, yeah, we when we went into this book, we always said we wanted to tell a story beyond Malema and the EFF, that we wanted to use Malema as a kind of window into corruption in South Africa, or at least a type of corruption, because we, you know, corruption's such a big story in South Africa. But Malema, as we've said, sort of exemplifies this type of like political, someone who melds political, well, politics and business, a sort of political entrepreneur, and someone at the center of a kind of a network. And so this is an attempt in telling the story of Malema and the EFF, an attempt to try and better understand corruption in this country and the intersection of politics and money, in the hope that we can sort of, yeah, that we can contribute in some way to disentangling these things.
Well, I can assure you from my perspective, you have certainly achieved that. Thank you for the efforts that you continue to make and for bringing it all together in one tome that makes it understandable now to those who maybe got a little confused with the various headlines. There are heroes in this book. Pravin Gordhan comes out very well, and Nhlanhla Nene, as mentioned before, those two whistleblowers who I think you said had to leave the country or go into witness protection. Terry Matau, the advocate for the VBS scandal, and of course the two of you. But it has been a pleasure talking with you. I hope you sell gazillions. I hope you get this made into a movie. If there's any justice, then Steinheist will be the first of many. And certainly this has got to be the next one. And I hope that you can continue in the efforts that you're making in your own ways. Poli van Wyk and Mike Reddy are the co-authors of the new book, which only gets launched next week, called Malema, Money, Power, Patronage. I've read it. You should. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.